Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hi, everybody. It's April 8th. I wanted to start out today with a clip from one of my favorite interviews ever. It was back in January of 2016. This is episode 406 of School Sucks. It is called Time Mastery, a conversation with Kevin Cruz. Kevin is the author of a best-selling book called 15 Secrets Successful People Know About Time Management. The book is a product of interviews with and research on over 250 highly productive and successful people. Kevin might be called a time management expert, but if it wasn't for a need to show up in Google search results, I think he'd much rather be known as an attention and energy management expert. And in that old episode, a lot of his advice relates to those things. And if you're intrigued or interested or motivated by today's show, this episode, which is linked in the show notes, is a great additional resource. At the time, back in 2016, a lot of Kevin's advice seemed like a bit of a stretch for me personally. But after a lot more reading, trial and error, and looking at the results of an experiment that I've been running throughout 2019, I've now concluded that what he was sharing in that show was like the best ideas ever for me personally. So, in today's presentation, I'm going to take some of those nuggets of wisdom and combine them with the work of several other attention and energy management experts. No guest today. It's just me and you. Listen with a friend if that makes you uncomfortable. Here we go.
So when it comes to the calendar, I mean, the first thing is, and this is, again, a key distinction from a to-do list and a key difference, you know, that I have from GTD, which is, again, a lot of people will use the calendar for official appointments and meetings and phone calls. I am suggesting everything gets put on the calendar. So you make an appointment with yourself using your calendar. Now, the other dimension other than time, though, is energy. So it goes back to this idea of energy management and realizing that we are not as productive and powerful at the end of the day as we are at the beginning of the day. You know, glucose drains out and we get tired. The only thing that really replenishes is sleep. So there's the, you know, behavioral psychologist Dan Ariely talks about this a lot, where he says we are most productive about 1 to 2 hours after we've woken up in the morning.
Amen.
And, you know, what a shame that so many of us, first thing we do, we get to the desk, we go into the office, whatever it is, and we open up email and we start slinging emails, or we want to clear the pile on our desk. So we start signing expense reports or booking our trip to Las Vegas. You know, we do silly stuff with our brain power time. So the first thing with the calendar is to really look at all those tasks that maybe right now are sitting on your to-do list and say, okay, the brain intensive stuff, the most important stuff, I am going to work on in the morning. The less taxing stuff or the less important stuff, I'm going to work on in the afternoon. So right there, there's a shift. And an important concept on this is, you know, what I call your MIT or your most important task.
Sure.
And, you know, Brett, this is similar to what I've heard you talk about before. You know, you've got your goals or your projects, and you break those down into a series of, you know, steps or tasks. And ideally, you've lined them up like dominoes. So in the GTD language, you know what your next action is to advance that.
Right.
And, you know, practically speaking, I mean, if you work in a company right now, you know, your workplace most important task isn't the thing that's going to keep you from getting fired, all that busy work. It's the thing that's probably going to get you promoted. You know, if you're an entrepreneur, you need to be thinking about, okay, now if I want to double the size of my business in 1 year, what's the number one thing that's going to make that happen? And whether that's, you know, hire a new vice president of sales or launch that e-learning course, that online course, you've got the thing that's going to take your business to the next level. Working on that thing is your most important task. And so every morning I try to do a 90-minute block of MIT time, most important task time. Now, I will have that block sticking out as a recurring daily appointment. And that tells me, hey, don't go make a breakfast meeting with somebody unless it's really an extreme case. Don't say yes to the dentist when they throw that first option out at you that's during your MIT time. Don't schedule a phone call. Leave Facebook closed. So I'm really strict on that MIT time. Now, my MIT might change day to day or week to week. So back to your question, Brett, about how do you look at that calendar? You know, I do like to make sure that at the end of one day, I've planned the next day. And so I've usually planned it. And the first thing in the morning, I'm looking at that calendar. And on that MIT, I mean, for me, from an author standpoint, a lot of days it's, you know, write the freaking book. You know, put my butt in the chair and write the book.
Mm-hmm.
If the book is written, it might be do some marketing. You know, I have a very specific thing that might change a bit day to day, but that MIT time is sacred. Now, I by default will, you know, it's not a coincidence to me that we're doing this podcast interview in the afternoon. And after yours, I've got another one. After that one, I've got a newspaper interview. So I try to schedule conversations, interviews, phone calls, you know, in my afternoons. And I literally, it sounds corny, Brett, but when I look at my calendar morning, I reinforce, I say, all right, how am I going to win the day? How am I going to win the day? Preferably by noon.
Everybody, I hope you enjoyed the last episode of the podcast, which was a free sample of our subscriber-only show, The Discomfort Zone. And thank you for the even more positive feedback since then about the show. I'm glad so many of you got to hear at least one episode of it. And on The Discomfort Zone, we tend to talk a lot about professional development, our professional development as basically self-employed, self-directed people. We do spend a lot of time talking about the personal things that can interfere with that. And one of the topics we've touched on a few times in 2019 has been this idea of block scheduling. So if you're familiar with the work of Tim Ferriss or Cal Newport, you might have heard a thing or two about this. You might already be doing it. And if you are, or even if you're like, "F that, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to be a slave to a calendar," I'm not going to try and change your mind. But I am going to try and make today's production still worth your while by talking about the backstory and some of the influences that led me to doing this. And maybe there's something useful for you in there, even if you have no desire to do block scheduling, or perhaps you have no need to do block scheduling. So that's how we're going to organize the show today. I'm going to give you a little bit of backstory as to, you know, some of the problems that I've tried to address with this experiment that I've been running through 2019. The things that influence me and motivate me to do it, the process that I use for doing it, which is very simple, and some of the outcomes, like what have I learned about myself? What are some tips and tricks I've picked up along the way that could reduce your friction if you decided you wanted to start it? And what are some things I still hope to achieve from doing this? Because there's still certainly plenty of room for improvement, but it has been enough of a success that I'm willing to talk about it on The Discomfort Zone. And while I was doing that a couple weeks ago, one of our live listeners, when we record the show, we stream it live. So live listener named Jack, hi Jack, this is the show I said I would make for you, said, "Do you have any good resources on block scheduling?" I said, "Jack, I will bring one into existence for you." So let's start with the backstory. We've spent a lot of time in 2019 talking about the glories of being your own boss. Man, if you told me when I was 16 years old, standing in a closet, like literally standing in a closet, my job was in a closet, making donuts, apple cider donuts, with two of the oldest men. They were so old they didn't even seem like real men. They were like the guys, the movie critics from The Muppet Show. I mean, what were they doing in this closet at that age, I would say? The three of us would work on this assembly line, dipping dough into hot grease and then putting them on a tray. And every once in a while, one of us, I think we would take turns. We'd go outside and bring the donuts up to the counter where they were sold, along with all the other apple-y things at the apple orchard. This was my first job. When you just talk about like predictability and definition in a job, this had it all. Right? It's like, who are my coworkers, the two oldest guys you've ever seen? Where am I allowed to be in this closet? What's my role in this whole assembly line? Ah, you're the guy who stands in the middle. And if the donut gets caught on the little conveyor belt there, you get a little stick you can push it along with. I don't have one question in the world about how to do this job. This was true with a lot of the jobs that I had. Always closely supervised, always working in very structured, very rigid environments where there were procedures and rules, and they, you know, and I was a young, compliant man trying to work my way up at a school. I was on the tracks, you know. But in my mid-20s, I had this one experience where I was so unsatisfied with my job that I said, these tracks suck and I don't want to be on them anymore, but I don't want to be unemployed. So how can I resolve that? And I started trying to make my job my own thing. I found this to be the most satisfying thing I had ever done at the age of, you know, 24, 25. And then I was like hooked on this idea of like everywhere I go, every job I take, how can I make it my own? And I started to be more excited about the possibility of freedom in my work. So yes, we talk a lot about the glories of being your own boss. But I've also realized several times a week as I look back on my day, I kind of suck at that a lot of the time. You know, with this great freedom comes great responsibility. And even though, you know, it's been an ongoing process and I've recorded a lot of it and presented it to you, I've tried to make improvements in professional self-discipline and time management, I still experience a lot of struggles with the amount of freedom that I have. I think about myself, and then I think about a lot of the people that I hope to help with the School Sucks Project, like unschooled kids. And, you know, I've traveled across the country. I've met a lot of unschoolers who are doing really amazing things, who are really inspiring, who are very self-directed. But I've also seen a lot of people in home educating environments. And this is mostly like more from afar. Like on there are some unschooling Facebook groups. There's some pretty questionable things being promoted in some of these places. But what I've realized, whether it works for them or not, these unschoolers are dealing with tremendous amounts of unstructured time. And if they're anything like me, an abundance of unstructured time can result, I'm not saying it will, but it can result in a lack of both self-discipline and the ability to manage time effectively. Now, obviously, in this void, there is a great opportunity to learn self-management. That's not the easiest thing to do. It's especially not easy today, where attention spans are being just filed down to nothing at a time where there has never been such a plethora of distractions to cater to those shrinking attention spans.
I spend a lot of time worrying about the young people in my family when I see some of that. And I have no control over this. I have not been successful in any intervention in these things. But some of the things that they're allowed to do and see and habits that are forming, I'm very concerned about it. And kids who have entirely unstructured time, there might even be more dangers. Not to say that those parents are uninvolved. And if you are an unschooling parent and you do have this totally laissez-faire approach, how does that work? I'm curious. I'm not in that situation. So I would love your feedback and I would love your expertise about that. But if you are a home educator and you do have some concerns about this, I think these things that I'm going to talk about will be helpful whether you're interested in block scheduling or not.
But let's do a little more backstory on me and we'll get into some of the things that influenced me to try this.
People say to me a lot, and I am not bragging. Wow, Brett, you can really get a lot done, huh? And I'm baffled by this. I say, are you sure you're looking at the right website? I mean, I feel busy, but I feel like I almost accomplish nothing. Certainly not the things that could really, really move the needle for me. Right? There's like lots of high leverage activities and actions that have been ignored. And, you know, my own history that I guess many of you are familiar with because I've been projecting it out publicly for quite a while. I have many times in the past gotten excited about some new methodology or tool related to productivity or time management. And as time goes on, I wind up sometimes, I would say rarely, but sometimes abandoning it completely and forgetting all about it. But usually I wind up with only traces of that thing integrated into my work life. David Allen's Getting Things Done has been the stickiest. I first started using Getting Things Done back in 2013. Fortunately for me, I discovered it the same week I discovered a program called Evernote. And the two, you know, Evernote is kind of made in many ways for getting things done, or you can make it into something that serves the principles of getting things done very well. In fact, in 2016, I did a kind of a tutorial video with my friend Drew Sample, and I'll link it in the show notes, but I showed Drew how to set up Evernote in alignment with GTD, and that's pretty much how I still use Evernote today. But I would say that I'm more of an Evernote guy than a GTD guy. And the problem with that, at least for me anyway, has been if you're not paying enough attention to the horizons of focus, like the multiple levels at which you live your life, or the natural planning model, like David Allen meant for all of this to be integral. And the picking and choosing approach that I've wound up taking to GTD through the years has left me not scattered, but kind of too down in the weeds too much of the time. But I'm not zooming out enough to see the big picture of everything that I'm doing and how much progress I'm either making or not making. And my needs, I think, are very different from a lot of people's. My life is simple, fun, comfortable, satisfied with what I do. But the more the like alternative media grows, and the more I observe other people, I'm realizing how much more I could do. And I say I'm certainly not working up to my capabilities, you know. Like I'm very aware, like I see people I think not as smart doing similar things and being way more successful at it. And so I've asked a lot of questions about that over the course of the last year. And, you know, I've started to find some answers. And this is obviously isn't any kind of panacea, but it's something that has been very helpful. So we'll move into some of the things that I've seen or read that influenced me and motivated me to try out a new way of managing my time. Time is incredibly precious, and in my life, it's been incredibly mismanaged because of the amount of freedom that I have. I have made myself a new boss, and the good news is he's me, but he's this other part of me, and we can negotiate a little. I know if I push too far, it's not going to be good for me. You will understand exactly what I'm talking about by the conclusion of today's show. So let's talk a little bit about what influenced me to try block scheduling. So at the end of last year, beginning of this year, I read a book, a simple old book that really changed a lot for me about the way I think about what I do. The book is called The E-Myth, Why Most Small Businesses Don't Work and What to Do About It. It was written, I think, originally in the 80s, and it was last updated at the dawn of the digital revolution. But it definitely contains wisdom that is still relevant, certainly to me, today. It describes the self-employed person or the small business owner as somebody who tries to play three distinct roles. This is the problem that the book lays out, and this is why most people get burned out. They wind up hating the thing that they thought they loved when they try to do it as a business. The three distinct roles are the technician, the manager, and the entrepreneur.
So the technician is the person who likes to do the thing that leads to the start of the business. The example used in the book is baking pies. Nathan Fraser and I also talked about this in the Anatomy of a Failed Passion Project episode, recent episode of School Sucks. So let's go through each one of these using the book. The manager. The managerial personality is pragmatic. Without the manager, there would be no planning, no order, no predictability. If the entrepreneur lives in the future, the manager lives in the past. Where the entrepreneur craves control, the manager craves order. Where the entrepreneur thrives on change, the manager compulsively clings to the status quo. The manager is the one who runs after the entrepreneur to clean up the mess. Without the entrepreneur, there would be no mess to clean up. Without the manager, there could be no business. Then, the technician. The technician is the doer. If you want it done right, do it yourself, is the technician's credo. The technician loves to tinker. Things are to be taken apart and put back together again. If the entrepreneur lives in the future and the manager lives in the past, the technician lives in the present. He loves the feel of things and the fact that things can get done. As long as the technician is working, he's happy. But only on one thing at a time. Put it another way, while the entrepreneur dreams, the manager frets, and the technician ruminates. And then the entrepreneur. From the book, the entrepreneur personality turns the most trivial condition into an exceptional opportunity. The entrepreneur is the visionary in us, the dreamer, the energy behind every human activity, the imagination that sparks the fire of the future, the catalyst for change. Now, if I just step back and look at myself in these three roles, I had a very good feeling that I spend almost all my time in the technician role, which could also be, depending on what the thing is, the artistic role. And the person who was put on the back burner in everything that I do is the entrepreneur. The person who's thinking about, like, do we have a vision and a mission for School Sucks? Sure. But what I like to do is create content, doing pre-production and research and spending way too much time doing that, and then recording the interview and spending probably sometimes too much time doing that, and then editing it and spending way too much time doing that, and then picking music for it and spending way too much time doing that. And at the end of each week, feeling like I did a whole bunch of stuff, but nothing that really moves the needle of the whole operation. And when I get burnt out or feel highly distractible when it comes to the technical, artistic tasks of this project, I can switch into manager crap. I can clean up my office. I can answer my emails. Things that are very comfortable, process-oriented, not at all challenging, almost like I have a boss directing me what to do. Time to make the donuts, I say to myself in those situations. And then occasionally, when the mood strikes, I can look at the bigger picture things in that other role, that entrepreneur role. But that was the role that I was most neglecting. So initially, I tried to block time for each at the beginning of this year: entrepreneurial tasks, managerial tasks, and technical artistic tasks. And just keep a record of behaving as natural and seeing where all my time went. And sure enough, I was right. It was going all towards technical and artistic tasks. And now I had a visual representation of this. I had proof. I had defined a problem to solve. Another influence was the productivity guru Brian Tracy, right? Who said efficiency is doing things right. Effectiveness is doing the right things. Your ability to plan and organize your work in advance so you are always working on your highest value tasks determines your success as much as any other factor. And then my webmaster Tony, introduced me to a phrase also, I think, coined by Brian Tracy, a phrase I never heard before: eat that frog. So I dug into that idea. We've also talked about this on the Discomfort Zone. But from the book, Mark Twain once said that if the first thing you do each morning is eat a live frog, you can go through the day with the satisfaction of knowing that is probably the worst thing that is going to happen to you all day long. Your frog is your biggest, most important task, the one you are most likely to procrastinate on if you don't do something about it. It's also the one task that can have the greatest positive impact on your life and results at the moment. The first rule of frog eating is, if you have to eat two frogs, eat the ugliest one first. This is another way of saying that
if you have two important tasks before you. Start with the biggest, hardest, and most important task first. Discipline yourself to begin immediately and then to persist until the task is complete before you go on to something else. Think of this as a test. Treat it like a personal challenge. Resist the temptation to start with the easier task. Continually remind yourself that one of the most important decisions you make each day is your choice of what you will do immediately and what you will do later, if you do it at all. The second rule of frog eating is, if you have to eat a live frog at all, it doesn't pay to sit and look at it for very long. And this is the most important part, I think. The key to reaching high levels of performance and productivity is for you to develop the lifelong habit of tackling your major task first thing in the morning. You must develop the routine of eating your frog before you can do anything else without taking too much time to think about it. Throughout the book, Brian Tracy goes over this four-step process again and again. Select your most important task, begin immediately, work on it single-handedly, and finish it. Now, I used to love to make to-do lists. And in Evernote, there's this little feature where it gives you a box next to each line, and you can put a check in the box, and it feels great. So every day, for years I did this, I would put a box next to everything I had to do that day, and I would check most of them, and I would feel accomplished. But they were never the high-leverage activities that I really needed to be doing, because the truth was, I simply didn't know how to do them. And because of the lack of knowledge, I became very skilled at making excuses. No one has ever tried to do exactly what I'm doing and make it successful. This is it's very hard to find an avatar. It's very hard to speak to one specific person. If I was in, you know, like, here's how you get chicks, or here's how you make more sales, or this is how you get in shape, those all have more clearly defined paths to follow to success, those kinds of online endeavors. This is something that nobody else has ever done. And that would be my excuse for not figuring out how to do it most effectively. But I can't sit there and not do things all day. So I would over-research. I would over-post-produce. And I would work on little cover art for episodes for too long. And I'd always have new content. You know, and for years, we've averaged like two new things a week between podcasts and bonus shows. But those things were not real priorities. They had to be done every week. And I would wrestle with this idea because, like, when you think about that quadrants, the four quadrants of prioritizing, urgent and important, not urgent but important, and not urgent, not important, content creation is kind of a tricky one, right? Because it is urgent. You got to do it every week. And it is important. It's what the whole operation is based on. And because it goes in that urgent and important quadrant, if you're not disciplined or if I'm not disciplined, I can let it fill that quadrant. And it can also spill over into important, not urgent, right? Like planning a show out. I can plan, record, and release shows whenever I want. So even though those things are important, there's certain tasks inside them that might not always be urgent. So I could probably fill that quadrant too. Well, that's both quadrants of importance being filled up with low leverage technical slash artistic work, creating podcasts in my case. So far we've outlined two influences leading me to block scheduling, Eat the Frog and the E-Myth. But it's only the first half of the book, the E-Myth, that deals with this problem of these three conflicting roles that can drive an entrepreneur or small business owner mad, drive him or her to hate the thing that they love so much at one point they thought they should do it as a business. The second half of the book deals with creating systems, processes, and procedures. And for almost a decade now, I've viewed podcast and video and bonus show creation as this open-ended artistic exploration. And I've even said things like, only I could do this way. I am doing something different and special. You know, I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, if I've never mentioned that before, and that's where Andy Warhol is from. So everywhere, all over this city, there are reminders in the forms of bridges and streets and museums and paintings and statues not to be a pretentious douchebag with an inflated sense of the importance of what you do.
And I've taken those reminders to heart. 500,000 people have figured out how to create podcasts. Some are better, most are worse. And if I want to truly be successful, it has to be seen as only a component, only a push marketing component of a larger project. My disdain for Andy Warhol has really helped me get a grip, I think, in a lot of ways. I've speculated about this elsewhere, but I've tried to picture, like, what would Andy Warhol be doing today if he were alive and still producing art? What would that art have devolved to? My best estimation is that he would be hosting these events where he brings a bunch of his sycophants together and he just farts. And then he gives the fart a name that is some pop culture reference, right? So he lets one go and he goes, I call that Weekend at Bernie's. And everyone goes, yeah, I could see that because it's funny, but it also is a reminder of death. I don't want to be anything like that. Like I said, 500,000 people have figured out how to create podcasts. It's a select few that are able to do it with, I think, really crucial, helpful, important messaging that can change people's lives, but also figure out a way to project it to the right people and create win-win situations for content creator and content receiver. And that is an area in which I am in need of improvement. So building off my recognition for the sort of open-ended, free approach to content creation, combine that with the lessons of the E-Myth and my strong dislike of Andy Warhol, who, by the way, he calls these events fart installations. He takes it that far, all right? But this combination of things has me saying about my podcast, okay, this is something that needs to be more process-oriented. So I've tried to discipline myself to do that. Some examples would be I'm getting closer to having a regular production schedule. It's tricky because there's so many other variables involved working with other people. But, you know, the goal, and I was sticking to it for a while and then it kind of fell off, was podcast Monday, bonus show Friday. And one of the ways that I've actually tried to discipline myself to work in a more process-oriented way when it comes to the podcast is by taking on production work for other people. So my friend Nathan has the Copy and Funnels Podcast Network. These are podcasts about sales and marketing, the kinds of podcasts I should be listening to, and I get paid to listen to them very, very closely. I also do a bunch of video production work for one of the shows called The Sales Gorilla, hosted by this awesome guy, Landon Porter, and I can't wait to get the next episode and start listening to it and working on it. So that's very cool. What I realize, I can do that work, both audio and video, much faster than most people could, right? Like if most people just create and try to edit their own podcast, I'm going to be better at it than they are. I help a friend's business by giving him a way to outsource work that he doesn't have time to do. I get externally imposed constraints on my time. If I have to meet deadlines for other people, I'm watching the clock more closely than I would if I lived only in my very capricious world. And I'm familiarizing myself and disciplining myself to follow a procedure in post-production. And through that, I've actually been able to create a process document of creating an episode of School Sucks Podcast in case, God forbid, somebody else ever needed to do it. So the outcome of this is the podcast is able then to become more constrained inside certain blocks of time. When I create a show and I'm interviewing somebody, my goal is to know more about that topic, to be able to provide color commentary to the primary speaker at a higher level of knowledge than, say, what Joe Rogan has, right? This is one of the most frustrating things about the Joe Rogan experience, even though I don't think it's Joe Rogan's job to be an expert on everything that he talks about. I think he's done his job of creating a forum. But I want to be, because, you know, all of the topics that we talk about are education related, I want to be a conduit between the expert that I'm interviewing and the person listening and learning about this thing, but I want to be as close to the expert side as possible. So in creating a process, pre-production is limited to a certain amount of time. Production is limited to a certain amount of time. Post-production, and this is where the most discipline is required, is limited to a certain amount of time. I have a giant red digital clock that counts seconds. Discomfort Zone co-host Andrew bought this for me that sits on my desk, and I can watch these seconds tick by. When it comes to things like finding the right clips, finding the right music, putting the music into the show the right way, all of that now has time limits. And it means that this low leverage, that this important but low leverage activity can only spread into so many working hours every week. And that wasn't the case before. So other influences, 3 and 4, we'll kind of do together. Tim Ferriss talks about this concept quite frequently through the 4-hour work week. It's called batching. Batching certainly is not a groundbreaking concept, but for those of us who do multifaceted knowledge work, it's very easy to become scattered. You get hung up on a certain task, or you're working through a project and you find yourself waiting for something from somebody else, and you switch, you veer into email. And obviously, if your phone is near you and notifications are on, that's disastrous. Don't rely on Facebook to communicate with people if you can avoid it, right? Like, I have to sometimes, if I'm working on something and I have a question or I need to collaborate with a person, Facebook might be how we communicate, which is why the messenger feature on your phone with the little chat heads can be very, very helpful, right? Because you can open your phone, press on your friend's little face, it opens your conversation, you write what you need to, you close it. God, before that existed and we were communicating with people on Facebook, you could lose an hour very easily. But there's thousands of ways for that to happen now. So batching is also related to the fourth influence, Cal Newport's deep work, where even though there's always a million things we could be doing, group similar work together into a block of time. Tim Ferriss talks about this as waiting for critical mass to accumulate. This is how we do laundry. This is how we go to the post office. Unless you get stamps.com, am I right, folks? Check them out at stamps.com. But even though, you know, we all live, the people who are trying to do better in the realm of productivity, we encounter this enormous clusterfuck of competing information online. One point of, I would say, near unanimity, frogs are what's for breakfast. Administrative tasks, the manager from the E-Myth, that stuff happens after lunch, right? That stuff happens when brain power has fallen below optimal levels. The morning is used for what Cal Newport calls deep work. And the length of a deep work session, so this is an experiment that I've been trying to finish a couple of projects that have been languishing for too long. Cal Newport, on his website, there was a blog article called Monk Mode Morning, which is the idea that when you wake up until noon, you have no meetings, no calls, no texts, no email, no internet. You work deeply on something that really matters. Now, that's the ideal. If you work in an office or you work in sales, that almost seems like it might be counterproductive. So I think establishing the monk mode morning as an ideal and then seeing how close we can get to it. So you have this nice alliterative heuristic. And if you find yourself opening Facebook or opening Twitter, or you forget to silence your phone, and just like you reach that moment of weakness, or you slow down, or you get frustrated, your phone goes, hey, look over here. Dang, dang. You know, like our phones do. But the big ideas in deep work, which is, I would say, an elaboration of what Tim Ferriss talks about in the 4-hour work week, obviously, for the most – the implied in the title, if you want to produce the top-notch work that you are capable of, if you want to, you know, work to your full capacity, your full capability, you need to commit to this idea of undistracted, deeply focused work, and the morning is the time. Another thing that's talked about in the book is the mastery of difficult new tasks, which is often required to produce at a high level, not just in terms of quality, but also in terms of speed. It's something that's highly valued in all sectors of business today, especially news and entertainment. Now, I don't know a lot of people who are producing amazing podcast or video content every day, but I know a lot of people who are producing like listenable and probably worth your 45 minutes if you have it type content every day. In the book, he also says the key to developing a deep work habit is to move beyond good intentions and add routines and rituals to your working life designed to minimize the amount of your limited willpower necessary to transition into and maintain a state of unbroken concentration. I would say, for me, the only time this is possible is the morning. And a way to put yourself on the right track to do this is to have that time clearly defined. So Cal Newport is definitely a proponent of meticulous and honest, we're going to talk about this too, block scheduling. Cal Newport on his blog claims that a 40-hour time-blocked work week produces the same amount of output as a 60-plus-hour work week pursued without structure. Steve Pavlina, the author of the Passive Income book, I learned about him while I was editing the audio book version of that book, actually, and we'll add him as another one of my influences, wrote a blog that my friend Joel recently told me about called Triple Your Personal Productivity. Blog's 15 years old, by the way, where the number one piece of advice was to keep a detailed time log and analyze your results. He says, the first time I kept a time log, I only finished 15 hours worth of real work in a week where I spent over 60 hours in my office. Even though I was technically about twice as productive as the average office worker, I was still disturbed by the results. Where did those other 45 hours go? My time log laid it all out for me, showing all the time drains I wasn't consciously aware of, checking email too often, excessive perfectionism, doing tasks that didn't need to be done, overreading the news, taking too much time for meals, succumbing to preventable interruptions. Oh man, how we succumb. Oh, and by the way, don't rush through eating. Don't sit there and shovel food into your face like you're in a prison cafeteria. Take a half hour. Remind yourself that life is something to be enjoyed and savored and chewed well. Oh, and in that paragraph that I read where he said he's way more productive than the average office worker, he wrote earlier in this blog, "You might be surprised to discover you're only spending a small fraction of your working time doing what you'd consider to be actual work. Studies have shown," I'd like more information about those three words, "the average office worker does only 1.5 hours of actual work per day. The rest of the time is spent socializing, taking coffee breaks, eating, engaging in non-business communication, shuffling papers, and doing lots of other non-work tasks. The average full-time office worker doesn't even start doing real work until 11 a.m. and begins to wind down around 3:30 p.m. And this was in 2005. There was no Facebook. There was no Instagram. There was no Twitter. There was no Pornhub mobile site to take with you into the bathroom stall. Oh my God, there wasn't even smartphones then. What were these people doing? And I couldn't find, by copying and pasting that phrase about the 1.5 hours a day into Google, but the results did include this from Inc.com. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the average American works 8.8 hours every day. Yet a study of nearly 2,000 full-time office workers revealed that most people aren't working for most of the time they're at work. The popular unproductive activities listed were reading news websites, checking social media, discussing non-work-related things with coworkers, searching for new jobs, taking smoke breaks, making calls to partners or friends, making hot drinks, yum, texting or instant messaging, eating snacks, yum, and making food in the office. And all of this added up to almost 6 hours of time. God, where's Frederick Taylor when you need him? Just kidding, just kidding. So I'm sorry, that was a tangent. I would say the most helpful takeaway from this blog, having a work log allows you to calculate your personal efficiency ratio. Pavlina writes, "When I realized that I spent 60 hours at the office but only completed 15 hours of actual work within that time, I started asking myself some interesting questions. My income and my sense of accomplishment depended only on those 15 hours, not on the total amount of time I spent at the office. So I decided to begin recording my daily efficiency ratio as the amount of time I spent on actual work divided by the total amount of time I spent in the office. While it certainly bothered me that I was only working 25% of the time initially, I also realized it would be extremely foolish to simply work longer hours." So here's the magic, that Pavlina magic. If you've ever tried to discipline yourself to do something you really weren't motivated to do, you most likely failed. That was naturally the result I experienced when I tried to discipline myself to work harder. In fact, trying harder actually demotivated me and drove my efficiency ratio even lower. So I reluctantly decided to try the opposite approach. The next day, I would only allow myself to put in 5 hours total at the office, and the rest of the day I wouldn't allow myself to work at all. Well, an interesting thing happened, as I'm sure you can imagine. My brain must have gotten the idea that working time was a scarce commodity because I worked almost the entire 5 hours straight and got an efficiency ratio of over 90%. I continued this experiment for the rest of the week and ended up getting about 25 hours of work done with only 30 hours of time spent in my office. So I was able to reduce my weekly working time by 30 hours while also getting 10 more hours of real work done. If your time log shows your efficiency ratio to be on the low side, try severely limiting your total amount of working time for a day and see what happens. Once your brain realizes that working time is scarce, you suddenly become a lot more efficient because you have to be. Now, I step back and I say, "Ooh, okay. There's two paths to time freedom here." Now, I thought about myself. I have the Studio of Champions here, as you know, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I spend more time in this room than any other room in my house, probably than all other rooms in my house combined. I eat in here. I entertain myself in here. And this is not new with the Studio of Champions. This has been the case with every production space I've had for years. It's just where I am all day. Work and life have no clearly defined lines between them. So work can just be potentially happening all the time. When it comes to time freedom, there are two paths. So one is what Steve Pavlina is talking about. To restrict your time in the space in which you work, which raises the value of the time you spend there by making it more scarce, and then gives you real time freedom every day when 4 o'clock rolls around, let's say, for you to go out and do what you want. Or there's the other path, the one that I use. Just pretend that you have time freedom by sitting in your office all day long with no clear definitions for your work and working for a half hour and going up and making a nice eggs and bacon breakfast and bringing it back in and saying, now it's time to watch a YouTube video during breakfast. But it's not like I'm going to sit there and watch something with no value. So I go to YouTube and I put in something that's educational, but entertaining. That's how I like to do it. And I start watching this video and munching on these, oh, I always do scrambled eggs with just a, you know, touch of feta cheese and a nice olive tapenade. And I start watching something that, at least in my mind, there's a story about how it could be useful for School Sucks Project. Either as content or it gets the gears turning a little bit in a different way. And 5 minutes into that, I look over into that right column and I see a suggested video. It's a picture of Jaime Lannister and it says, "The top three fighters in Game of Thrones, according to Jaime." And as I continue to eat, a voice in my head, it starts as a whisper and it seems to grow louder and louder with each bite of delicious eggs. "You need to know." "You need to know who the three fighters are. One must be the Mountain. One must be Bronn. But who is the third?" Okay, click. That's not real time freedom. Real time freedom is getting the hell out of this room and getting the hell away from the computer at 4 o'clock every day. And that is one of my goals. So thank you to the E-Myth, to Brian Tracy, to Tim Ferriss, Steve Pavlina, and Cal Newport for motivating me to try a new way of managing my time. And before we go on, I just want to touch on a couple additional concepts. First one's called attention residue, and it's mentioned by both Brian Tracy and Cal Newport. Attention residue is the idea that every time you switch activities, a residue of attention gets stuck with the previous task, leading to a reduction in performance on the next task. So this is obviously an argument for those deep work sessions in the morning where there is no previous activity to deplete your attention or your willpower. You're not bringing anything else into the deep work session with you. It's a consideration when you start to experiment with block scheduling, and I learned this the hard way. I was like, ooh, it'd be a fun day to, you know, because I've got these, according to the E-Myth, these entrepreneur tasks, these manager tasks, these production tasks, and I could just, you know, shift back and forth every 45 minutes to an hour, depending on what it is, hour and a half, 30 minutes for some things. But doing this throughout the day is very, it's not as bad as multitasking, but it's almost as bad as multitasking. And I've really had to like pay attention to what my mental state is like at various times of the day between 7 a.m. and 4 p.m. And that has helped me figure out like what activities should go where. Like I used to have meetings in the morning. This is no good. That is prime time for doing focused work. And so I've cleared all my mornings for the long, focused, intense work session. And it took more than a month of just playing around with block scheduling before I could even get into these deep work states. You ever seen like a picture of Steve Jobs' desk or Albert Einstein's desk? And people say, this is what the desk of a genius looks like. Okay, that's what the desk of two specific geniuses look like. I would think most people whose desks look like that are people who are about ready to go on shooting sprees. If you think about GTD and you think about what GTD aims to prevent, that is like the starting point, right? That is the crisis situation that GTD was set up to resolve for a knowledge worker. But that was basically my mental and physical workspace for a long time. And anytime, like I already mentioned this, but anytime I encountered a frustration or a sticking point in a certain thing, I could just switch into something else. And I did not have this vocabulary, attention residue. So I didn't see how much I was depleting, and I didn't understand the cost of doing this. There's this obscure, I think it was a PlayStation game called Katamari Damacy. The plot line for this game is so confusing that you're better off not knowing about it. So if this is the first you're hearing about it, I'm sorry. But the character in the game, the character you're playing, I think he's trying to win the affection of some woman whose dad is like a king from space, and he doesn't like you. Or maybe he does like you, and he's getting you to do things to prove your worthiness to marry the daughter. But the action that you do is you have to go and pick up stuff with your body by rolling around. So you start out just as a guy, and then you start rolling around through all of these scenes and picking up debris. And the more debris you pick up, you turn into this larger and larger ball, able to pick up larger and larger things, right? So you're just picking up like little pieces of paper and toothpicks and maybe a little shrub. Eventually you can pick up like 18-wheelers, and I think you reach planet size. Now, this might work to your benefit in Katamari Damacy, because this is how you get the girl. But in real life, think about going from email to personal matter, to phone call, to project, to other project, to third project, to checking back on project from yesterday, and just having your whole day structured like this, which is what I used to do. Always feeling busy, but as the day wore on, increasingly weighted down by all of the debris that I was picking up as I shifted rapidly from one task to another. Also, by the way, if you're very young and you listen to my Katamari Damacy story, like, and you're new to dating, despite what I said, rolling around in garbage until you become like a big ball of garbage is not a good strategy usually for winning the affection of women. And it's also not a good way metaphorically to conduct your daily activities. So multitasking, worst possible situation, quickly shifting every half hour, every 45 minutes, every hour into different tasks also is going to produce high levels of attention residue. But obviously our days have to work like that sometimes. So those shorter work sessions that are more the managerial stuff, I've found putting them in the afternoon after lunch when attention starts to fall off anyway, and I don't need 100% of mental energy. Also, I find that later in the week, I have like a form that I use every week to write goals for that week, to just track my morning routine, track my daily activities. This is the last remaining checkboxes that are in my life anywhere. So like every Sunday or Monday, I'll set a bunch of goals for the week. And then I'll lay out daily routines with my checkboxes that I love. So, you know, previous night, did I read? Did I plan? Did I get the coffee and, you know, all the things I need for the morning set up? Did I floss? Now, those young boys that I was just giving dating advice to, this is something that you are going to want to try if you're interested in picking up women. So that's like previous night stuff. Then there's morning routine stuff. Meditate, make my bed, hydrate, journal, spend 10 minutes at my dry erase board, Megaplex, looking over everything. And there's daily processes like reviewing my calendar, reviewing my finances, reviewing weekly goals, emptying my Evernote inbox. And I see that from Monday to Friday, the number of checkboxes diminishes almost every week. So I've realized that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that has to be prime time. Morning is more valuable. Earlier in the week is more valuable. I don't know why I still believe in or follow the typical work week. And I do wind up having work spread into the weekends a lot. The other thing I would say that's important is a certain amount of environmental control when it comes to these deep work sessions. I wouldn't try to do this. I guess everybody has different levels of distractibility. I'm easily distracted. So I wouldn't try to do a 2-hour deep work session like in a coffee shop. I have the office or the studio where I have a standing desk, and that's where I pretty much spend my morning. That's where I'm standing right now. I also have a standing porch railing out in front of the house, you know, where I can set up a laptop and stand there. And the sun comes up right in front of me. You know, if I get out there at 6:30, the sun's coming up. It's beautiful. But I also know there's more potential distractions out there. So depending on the kind of work you're doing, this activity needs to have a location where you control as many variables as possible. And regardless of where that is, you have to give yourself a specific time frame, hence block scheduling. And taking Steve Pavlina's advice, you don't want to have huge 3-hour blocks of time. I mean, when I first was experimenting with this, I mean, I guess I've done like similar types of calendar experiments in the past. I remember after I had Kevin Cruz, the author of a time management book, New York Times bestseller, and he was saying block your schedule every 15 minutes. And I was like, I'll hear you out, but that's not GTD. GTD says only have, you know, firm meetings, like inflexible things in your calendar. But in this current, like earlier in 2019, it would be like I would just make a 3-hour block of time and just call it entrepreneur, like based on the e-myth. This is entrepreneur time. Well, that never worked. It needed to be specific. It said in this time, we're going to do this thing, and it's not going to be 3 or 4 hours, right? Because so much can happen in 3 or 4 hours. It's going to be 50 minutes. Then it grew to 120 minutes. And a block that size might only happen once a day. And Cal Newport also says that these sessions need rules and processes that keep you structured. So the time limit is probably the most important thing, but your phone's in the other room. The internet is closed. Anything that's going to create notification distractions is gone. You have your drinks set up. You know, if it's the morning, you've got your coffee and your water, and you're also properly satiated to stay in one place for a couple hours. So these are all important considerations in setting this up. And now, finally, let's move on to the process. So the process of block scheduling has 4 steps. You plan, you block, you act, and you revise. And there's 2 ways that you can do this, right? You could do it on paper, which eventually I think will lead for most people with the inability to execute a day perfectly according to plan, where eventually you reach such a high level of frustration that you use that paper as kindling to burn your house down. Or you could use something like Google Calendar, where everything just moves around. Things can be lengthened, shortened. There's no scribbling. There's no crossing out. There's no erasing. And because of that, I lean more towards Google Calendar. Also, this whole let Google do it movement, not a fan. So if you're a time management guru and you're still listening to this for some reason and you have a better tool than Google Calendar that isn't Apple related, that's a whole other speech that I will spare you. But I knew how Google Calendar worked when I started doing this. It allows you to create multiple color-coded calendars, which is also very useful because, like Steve Pavlina said, this is just as much about tracking how you spend your time as it is dictating how you spend your time and how you're able to say yes and no to incoming potential commitments based on what's already on this calendar. So in tracking our time, what's better than color coding? And you might be asking, aren't you the kind of man that would have dry erase boards everywhere with dry erase markers, all the colors of the rainbow? Yeah, sure. Of course I am. The Google Calendar has just been the easiest, most natural tool to use for doing this. And while we're talking about the web side of this, I use Firefox. Now, if you use Chrome or you use Safari, I'm pretty sure that with those two browsers, there is some kind of equivalent of this Firefox add-on that I'm about to tell you about. It's called Simple Tab Groups. And this is one of the most reliable distraction control tools I have. And what this allows you to do is instead of having, you know, two or three different windows with 50 tabs open in one and three open in the other, and then you open a new browser window and you say, this is the browser window that's going to be organized. This one's only going to have 10 tabs open in it. I'm speaking from experience. With Simple Tab Groups, you only need one window open, and you set up these groups of tabs, right? So if you have tabs that you always need to have open, or things that are incomplete, or things for some reason you haven't clipped into Evernote yet, if you use the Evernote web clipper, you can manage hundreds of open tabs without being overwhelmed or losing anything by grouping them together around themes. So you install this browser add-on, and then you can just create as many groups as you want. So I have a group called Website, which is all the things related to the New School Sucks website. I have a tab called Reading and Show Prep, which is initially when I open articles and I'm looking at things to do, potentially do shows about, they'll go in this browser. You can easily, you just right-click on any tab, and the last option in the menu is move to tab group, and you just pick the one where you want it to go. So if I do happen to be like browsing online and I see something that I'm interested in, I just move it to that tab group and I can take a look at it when I get a chance, right? Batching it with similar types of explorations to do, but also using Cal Newport's advice, putting it into a proper context. So like I know where to go. So even though it's not physical space in my world, it's space on my computer. But when it's time to do this, I know where to go. When it's time to work on the virtual summits, I go to tab group University Summits. There's six tabs open and each tab has something to do with research methodology. When it's time to work on that, that's the only window on my computer. That's the only internet browser window I need to see. So my tab groups are Website, Reading and Show Prep, Entertainment, Autonomy, my friend Richard Grove's course that I'm currently going through. That has its own group with various tabs open. Digital Marketing Career Blueprint. That's Seth's course. I'm currently going through that. Calendar has its own whole tab group. Calendar is the only tab that is ever open in that group. And then another tab, Bonus Show Production, where I'm going through and finding clips to put on Subscribestar. So Subscribestar and Patreon are also open in that window. Simple Tab Groups is a great tool for minimizing clutter and setting the proper context. If you have multiple types of work that you're doing, multiple avenues you go down in your work, that is a great tool to use to only have in front of you what you need. If you do need to use the internet during a deeper work session, I highly recommend that plugin if you use Firefox. The process, again, plan, block, act, revise. Well, how do you plan? Before you can schedule these blocks of time, you obviously need to know what you need to be doing during them. So I set weekly goals, things that I'm going to accomplish every week, and those things are usually smaller pieces of larger goals that might take many months or a year or multiple years to accomplish. I divide my life along those lines into the following categories: emotional well-being, where I achieve 50%+ of the goals that I set; health and fitness, where I achieve 90%+ of the goals that I set; hobbies and enrichment, which is obviously learning new skills or reading lists. And because that is lower priority, I probably achieve less than 20% of the goals that I set. Home and social life, which is just about, showing up at events, meeting with friends, doing tasks around the house, getting things for the house, not really very goal oriented. So that doesn't really apply there. Personal finances, probably achieve less than 50% of the goals that I set. And School Sucks Project, where I probably achieve less than 30% of the goals that I set, trying to get that number up. And everything that needs to be done can also be divided into projects and procedures. So projects are things that have to be done once. I need to build a new website. Other things are procedures or processes, like creating new content every week. I've also realized that long chunks of deep work, like I said, first thing in the morning, collaboration, meetings around or after lunch, the things that don't require a great amount of mental energy or focus can go at the very end of the day. And I usually try to put as much thought into how a week will go as possible on Sunday, blocking out as much of the week as I can. So starting with things that are firm commitments, appointments, the morning routine that I do every morning that takes about a half an hour, then the deep work session, then all the regular weekly commitments that I have, meeting with people, all that stuff's already on the calendar anyway, and it provides guideposts for how I can plan other things. So I look at what needs to be done that week, and I start filling it in. And the more you can live consciously through this process, the better. So I've even learned things about myself, like if I want to have a fun conversation, like an episode of The Discomfort Zone, best time for that, like afternoon, evening would be great, weekend would be great. It's just me and my friend talking mostly in a constructive fashion, but it's supposed to be fun for you, the listener. So, you know, that's a great thing to do when the big heavy stuff in the week is already done. But if I'm interviewing somebody new for the podcast, somebody that I haven't spoken to before, I want to be sharp, I want to be on my toes, I want to be well prepared, that might get a deep work session in the morning. That might get the first session in the morning where I'm fresh, there's no depletion, there's no distraction, and I can really dig in for 90 minutes with that person and have the best conversation possible. Not saying I can't do it at 1 o'clock after lunch or at 7 o'clock after the gym. Like, those things are possible, but I'm just trying to set up the optimal conditions to do the best interview possible. It's probably 8:30, 9 o'clock a.m. And the more deliberation, you know, not like time-wasting deliberation, but the more deliberation you can do about it and going through this process of scheduling and at the end of the week looking back at your schedule. The only thing I don't like about, I don't know a way around this, is like you can't see on Google Calendar at the end of the week how much you shifted things around. It's counterproductive in time management if it takes you like 5 hours a week to deal with all this stuff. This is not a lot of time. I mean, once you get into a rhythm of doing this, it's like 10 minutes a day and maybe an extra accumulation of 5 to 10 minutes moving things around. It's not a big time commitment to do block scheduling. Not doing it steals a hell of a lot more of my time. But on the weekend, if I do spend a couple hours doing a weekly review that has, you know, many facets to it, I would like to see how much I was changing. I guess I'd have some memory of it if I feel like I'm shifting things around a lot. When you start doing this, you're going to be shifting things around all the time. And then as it becomes more natural, I find that I'm sticking to the schedule better and better each week. So as far as the when is concerned, obviously you can't perfectly plan your week on a Sunday or a Monday morning. So Cal Newport's suggestion was setting up an afternoon or evening practice that blocks out just the next day. I definitely recommend when you get up in the morning that the next day is taken care of. And it doesn't mean that it's going to perfectly go that way, but at least you get up in the morning and you have a plan ready to go. Plan your day the previous night. One thing that you definitely do not want to do is go back to back to back to back to back to back to back, because then you're just setting yourself up to have, as I talked about before in my screeds against calendars, a visual record of you breaking commitments to yourself. There are chunks of time, half hour where there's nothing, an hour where there's nothing. You know, if my work day basically goes from 7 to 4, that's 9 hours. If I can do real work for 6 of those hours, that's insane. And we've been over this a couple times, but I'm going to say it in a different way. Take defensive action against the kinds of things that creep into your schedule, especially if you're not good at saying no to other humans. Block time just vaguely. And the best example of this is that deep work session in the morning. Now, I screwed this up at the beginning when I read the E-Myth and I said, oh, okay, so I'm just going to make big chunks of time every day for entrepreneur stuff, smaller chunks of time for production, and then just the most diminutive little blocks for managerial tasks, right? Not because those things aren't important, but you could just pretend to be busy all day doing email. But if you pack it into an hour 3 times a week, and yeah, I know that means that I'm never getting back to some of you, but I shouldn't even say that. I didn't even understand that at first. I didn't know if these things should get equal time. I just knew I had to divide my life into these three categories and track how much time I was spending in each. What I realized is that every you know, hour, 2 hours of time needs a specific task in it. Schedule with specific tasks. This is what I'm going to be doing in this amount of time. But as you start to become more expert in this, you'll know what needs to go where. But I know now. I know if somebody says, "Can you do this between 8 and 10:30 on Thursday?" The answer is no. Yeah, you know, there might be some person who brings some great opportunity that says, "I can only do 9 o'clock on Thursday." Well, shit, you know, that kind of blows Thursday morning. But if that activity has more leverage than, you know, a nice long session of focus work in the morning, I guess that's the way it's got to be. But almost always the answer can be no, right? So that's a defensive action, because you don't know how many things are going to shake out in the week, or how priorities are going to shift, or deadlines might change, or new things might be thrown at you. You know, that 8 to 10 every day can just be DW when you start, deep work. Something meaningful is going to happen during that time, even if you don't know what yet. And then you can decide the previous night, or, you know, worst case scenario, the next morning. But you know how that time is going to be used, and you know no one or no thing is going to steal it from you. And I love that, because that's the boss I need, right? That's the boss who thinks weeks ahead. I know Brett will be best doing this from 8 to 10. And then he can do these other things, or make these other commitments later in the day. So that takes us into step three. I hate to admit this, but there's been so many times where my school mind has looked for someone to turn to and say, "What should I do?" And keeping these kinds of records and following this kind of process has answered almost all of those questions. The calendar tells me what to do, and then I do it. And this continues throughout the day until the day is over. Every day, Brett? No. And yeah, I'll be honest with you, there are deeper reasons why a person may not do certain things, certainly in my case. We've obviously talked a lot about self-knowledge on this show and the psychological roots of procrastination. There's a series on both if you want to go find them. I did a series in 2015 called Stop Procrastinating Now or Soon. Also in 2015, Adverse Childhood Experiences and Resilience, 2014 and 2016, the sixth and seventh pillar of self-esteem. Yeah, I'll be honest, I still have unanswered questions about myself. And I think there's still, just thinking in terms of like IFS, there are still some blocks in doing certain things because of negative self-talk or even irrational fears. And in some cases, and I'm not going to go into detail, rational fears. But in terms of emotional health, there's been days where I reach 4 p.m. and I say, "What a waste of a day. Man, I have no discipline." And of course, there's ways to talk yourself through that more constructively, but you don't want to do that to the point where you think you have excuses for just having more days like that. Don't stop at acceptance. Move on to responsibility and assertiveness. And when 4 o'clock comes and I feel like I set a plan for myself for the day and I followed it, even if I didn't get everything done, even if everything isn't in the perfect form that I want it in, that accumulating sense of accomplishment is really, really satisfying. And I have both types of days. Have I had a real like turd of a day this week or last week? No. But man, the week before that, I think I had a couple. And when you have those days, or when I have those days, they have less of a negative impact when I know the next day can be great again, if I may. So we're still talking about the action phase of honoring the best you can, the blocks you create for yourself. And just one final thing on that before we move on to the fourth step, the very important step of revision. The more clearly I define what a block should be, the less likely I am to stray into something else during that time. The more that is building discipline to stay on that thing during that time. And Cal Newport's concepts, and you can find out plenty, I'm sure, if you're interested in learning more about deep work, I'm sure you can find out plenty of information about it online for free. If my explanation has left you with any questions, of course, after all, it is a whole book. All right, so the fourth and final step, revise. Not one day since I've started doing this has gone exactly according to plan. And I think there's four main times where revision happens. The beginning of the day, the end of the day, the beginning of a block, the end of a block. A benefit that I still hope to realize is working more efficiently. I promise you, you can't tell. Maybe you can tell a little. I'm sure it took me way too long to record this podcast. Probably took me too long to edit it, and I'm working on that. And I probably had to drag a little, blocks of time to make them longer. Probably had to add a few more blocks of time for this project than I originally planned. The other thing, too, is that I think a higher priority here is being efficient and effective in doing your best work and not being a taskmaster. So don't prioritize the calendar over getting something meaningful done. If let's say, you know, I set up a deep work session for myself and 10:30 comes and that's the end. I have the big clock telling me to the second what time it is. And I'm really on a roll and there's like a half an hour break to eat and then 45-minute session labeled correspondence. I might work through that break and then break during that correspondence thing because that's not a super important activity. If something is a kind of discrete, small project, you might finish it early. It's obviously another reason why you would adjust the time. And occasionally I have found myself like dragging my feet to like finish out a block. You know, it's like 11:30. I've run out of steam for a thing. The block goes to 11:50. So I just start to like not dilly-dally. I just have lost like a lot of my intensity. I'm still only looking at those set of tabs or doing, you know, some level of work related to that thing, but I just don't have it anymore. I just shorten that block. If I need the rest of the half hour off, I take it. The efficiency and effectiveness is more important than just adhering to the schedule. But those are examples of times when revision happens. And if I ever blow it, like if I really just, I'm having a shitty day and I lose focus in the middle of something and I have to walk away from it, I make a note of that. I want an accurate record of my work through this, but I also want to be effective and efficient. So if noting like, hey, something went wrong here helps me from making that mistake again in the future, that's great. So those are the four steps. Planning, which is a weekly and a daily activity. Blocking, which is a weekly and a, I would say, hopefully, ideally a nightly activity for the next day. Acting, all-day activity. Revising, a few times throughout the day activity. And I'd like to conclude today with some lessons that I'm going to turn into tips to help you, if you want to try this, make it as frictionless and frustration-free as possible. So, the first one has to do with batching things together. When you start trying to do this, make small batches if it's not an activity you enjoy. When I started doing this, and I was using more the E-Myth formula, I'd make a two-hour block of time called managerial tasks, which would include something like email. That's too long. And lots of stuff can happen inside your email. There's lots of things to read, especially if your email looks anything like mine. I'm on, you know, several lists of people that I'm really interested in. What, you know, Kevin Geary, Tom Woods, Ben Settle. If you're already doing something that you don't enjoy, you're going to be, or I'm going to be anyway, more susceptible to distractions. So the shorter those batches are, using that Steve Pavlina approach, the more focused you're going to be because you have a greater awareness of the scarcity of time. But with other types of work, in the beginning, I recommend overestimating how long they will take and blocking additional time. So for those higher leverage types of tasks, make more time. And that leads to another tip. Don't schedule everything. I was very overzealous when I started doing this, and I would make these very, very packed, ambitious daily schedules. I could put together 2 or 3 hours of work a couple of times a day, but even when I make those blocks, every block is only 50 minutes long, right? You can go into the settings in your Google Calendar and you can pick, you can customize a standard event size. And I do 50 minutes because that leaves the last 10 minutes of every hour free, which you need to use the bathroom, to hydrate, to walk around. For certain types of people are going to need to check their phones. So the point of time blocking, in addition to the very valuable exercise of keeping a record of your time, is just to create a directed, predictable, focused flow of work through the day. It's not to torture yourself. That's not what time freedom is about. So just like we've talked about in the past on the show with like the Pomodoro method, work for 25, break 5, I've done pretty well with work for 50, break 10. So when you do it, and you know, I'll do a screenshot of my calendar so you can see what it looks like, leave blank spaces and walk away from the desk or the computer or whatever during those spaces. Otherwise, if you're like me, you're just depleting focus and willpower if you sit there too long. A way to make this more frictionless, define what you're going to do during a block of time. Like you could, if you want, just, you know, block off that morning routine every morning. Deep work after that every morning for a couple hours. But make sure in your calendar you're filling out, ideally, again, the night before, what happens during that time in a clear and concrete way. So when that time comes, there's not a lot of fumbling around and figuring things out. You can just pick it up and go. This will also help you more accurately estimate how long things will take, the more clearly you define them in your schedule. A management block just called communication, that I could get really creative with that, you know? But if that block is called process email back to April 1st, there's no mistaking what needs to be done during that time. That also helps me accurately estimate the amount of time that it will take. For block scheduling, I recommend relying on the phone as little as possible. Obviously, if you sync your calendar to your phone will give you notifications, but you can also set it up in Google so your desktop, you just get little desktop notifications. On Windows 10, something just slides in from the right and says, this is happening next, I think 10 minutes, and you can customize how often and with how much warning you want those notifications to. Another important thing to remember as far as frictionless and frustration minimization, deep work is a skill. In the book, Cal Newport says, getting the most out of your deep work habit requires training, and as clarified previously, this training must address two goals, improving your ability to concentrate intensely and overcoming your desire for distraction. And he says throughout the book that this is something that really, for most of us, needs to be fostered over a long period of time. Am I getting a bit of a late start with this? Sure. But when you're new and you start trying to do this, it will feel good to have a two-hour successful session. But I would say when you start trying to do these deep focus sessions, do it with not the most challenging work, right? Train yourself through challenging but not super challenging tasks and activities to get into that focus state if you struggle with that. And as time goes on, add more challenging types of work. Another one, I got this from something called the Road Warrior blog. This was an article about block scheduling written by Coleman Collins. And this is something that I've mentioned a few times, but it's worth reiterating here at the end. Don't sweat it too much when things change, but give time grudgingly. Blocks are ultimately a best guess as to how your day will shake out, and they're almost never 100% accurate. I have never had, in all the time I've spent doing this, one day that went perfectly as I planned it. Stuff comes up. Things take longer than you expect. An urgent crisis blows up your entire day. It's not a big deal. Having a plan to work towards is much more important than precisely sticking to it. But as much as possible, make sure you are the person that chooses when and how things change. Last-minute regroups or meetings are always going to happen. But the whole trick of time blocking is that for sudden interruptions to be allowed, things have to move. Make a show of it even. Show them your bright red calendar, then reblock right in front of them. Not only does this keep you honest to your priorities, it makes your client or colleague value and feel valued for the time they're being given. And to that I would add, don't let this make you inflexible. My goal is to be able to say yes to things that matter, to fun, to novelty, and to connection. Constant busyness, I think, feels terrible. But what's worse is telling the people that I care about over and over again that I'm too busy. Last night, I had a beautiful Japanese dinner, which included a spicy tuna roll and a nice steamed seafood shumai. Wasn't on my schedule. And I had stuff to do, you know, like getting towards the end of the week, I had things that needed to be done. But man, I had already felt so accomplished by 3 p.m. that day that when I was asked to dinner, I said, yeah, you know what? Yes. And it was a lovely evening. And I want more lovely evenings. Not to the sense that like Jim Carrey did it in that movie. Was it movie? Yes, Man. Not like I don't want to wind up in a cult, but I want to have more, you know, connection and quality time with friends and loved ones, for sure. And getting out of here, this room, and into the world every day at, you know, 4 o'clock is definitely something that can help change that. So a problem that I've talked about myself before on the show is I'm a yes sayer, right? This actually came up in that time management show with Kevin Cruz 3 years ago, where I said, gosh, you know, somebody asked me to do something and I say, sure, there must be 300-400 hours in a week. But being a yes sayer eventually makes you a no sayer to those things that seem superfluous because they're not work or business related. So having this calendar in front of you every time another person puts a proposition forward or makes a request for a portion of your time from the week, looking at this schedule turns you into, well, turned me into what I think I need to be, a no-sayer. And I've watched being a no-sayer first actually lead to me being able to say yes to more things that are fun and free. And what's the point of life if you can't do that? So my big takeaways personally from this experiment, which I will continue to do and which I will continue to refine and improve. And these things are, you know, personal. They apply just to me. But if you're still listening and you're still intrigued, then I think they're worth stating here at the end, even though a lot of them are review. I prioritize shallow work, I've learned, from doing this block scheduling. Production work, which makes me feel busy or feel productive. As a result, I don't spend enough time on entrepreneurial thinking. Management tasks. So again, these are all working through the three personalities in the E-myths, sap my energy. So they should never be done in the morning. Things that are often hard to place in that matrix of priorities. So Brian Tracy actually talks about this other method for setting priorities. It's the ABCDE method. A is very important, something that you must do. There's serious negative consequences if you don't do it. B is important, something that you should do, minor consequences if they're not completed. C is things that are nice to do. This is where I spend a good portion of my time here. D are things you should delegate, and that's probably where a lot of the management tasks fall. E are things that you should eliminate. You can think of the ways that you get distracted during the day and make your own unique list. But that's more useful, you know, trying to think about something like management, really low leverage management type tasks that you might have to do in your work. Or even if they're not management tasks, like blog writing. In my current state of confidence in my writing skills, it would take me like a week to write a 600-word blog. Could that change? Could I be better? Sure. But right now, that's not a good use of my time. So if I can outsource or delegate that, that's the right move. I manage my time less effectively as the week goes on. So I found that I'd have, as I looked back, you know, week after week after week, February and March, a lot of times I'd have a really ambitious schedule, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and then much more open blocks of time. Like some days, Friday didn't even have anything scheduled. So I know that on Sunday or Monday morning, if I have a clear idea of what needs to happen that week, I know when it needs to happen too, which is like Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. As I mentioned, I don't have clear enough boundaries between life and work. I spend way too much time in the studio of champions, and I'd like to be able to turn everything off in here and shut the door at ideally 4 p.m. each weekday. And one of the biggest ones, going back all the way to the beginning of the show, I need to be managed, but I am the only manager that I have, and I am the only manager that I want. So this process, which is one aspect of self-management, has so far solved that problem for me, and I'm going to stick with it. So ideally, one of the things that I'm working towards is that all of my work is condensed into the hours of 7 a.m. to 3 or 4 p.m. Monday through Friday, and then weekends are free for travel and exploration and recreation and socializing. So that is an overview of how I practice block scheduling and the benefits that I've realized so far. Thank you to Jack for suggesting this as a show. You made me think about it a lot more carefully and deeply, and we will leave it there. Feel free to send me your questions. I could always follow up with another episode. There's lots of aspects of this that I only touched on. You know, you think about the work of Brian Tracy, Cal Newport, Tim Ferriss. There's lots of aspects that could have been their own whole production. So let me know what questions or feedback that you have. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and take care. Someday I had a feeling that nothing could go right. It started out this morning with a never-ending fight to reach down deep inside myself and say, okay, I can get out of bed now. But negativity just could not stop there. The whole I was a self-defeat. Shit today, yeah, I'm taking me home.